grown, you know. I sometimes need a spanking.
Oh!
Tragic death of one of America's most gifted film directors, Alan Pakula.
That was very upsetting. I'm a pretty steely guy, except that one really got to me.
Just removed from the world.
Nabokov writes about it, and he says, beauty always dies.
He had an affinity for women, and I loved him for that.
What Alan and I shared was this sense of paranoia about where the truth was.
Oh, he would be very turned on by this particular moment in time. Yeah, I would think so, yes.
Pakula was an artist. That's all. He was an artist.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Thank you so much for joining us for this very special bonus episode. Throughout the show, if you're a really obsessive listener, you would have noticed I spoke to a friend of mine who's actually working on the Secret Handshake project called Jacob Hall, who said, Blake, do you know that there's an actual documentary about Alan Pakula right now called Going for Truth? I got to see it at a film festival. Rightly so. I think if anyone was listening, freaked out that A, I hadn't heard about it, and B, I hadn't had a chance to see it. And, 2020 happened, and this really excellent film is now finally making the rounds. And in Australia, it's going to the Jewish International Film Festival, screening around the place in Australia at the moment. And I'm lucky enough to talk to a man who is self-confessed, rather than being obsessed with Star Wars as a kid, obsessed with the work of Alan Pakula, a man after my own heart. Matthew Miele, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes and here to talk about your film.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So as part of the research of us chatting, you're a guy who's dabbled in features. You've done a bit of screenwriting. You've got upcoming features going. You talked about the benefit of a documentary film being something that, like, just knowing where to put your camera, not necessarily having the budget, and just having the inclination that a story is there to tell, to begin telling. What was the lure for you with Alan Pakula? Was this an itch to scratch for a long time? Like, how did you come to this man? Because I think right now it's a really strange and weird time. Like, we've been trying to connect for a couple of weeks now, but it just feels like your documentary is now about to get a wider distribution and many more people are about to see it. And with the recent release of the Parallax View on Criterion Collection, the world is kind of starting to be ready to reappraise Alan Pakula. Maybe both of us were a couple of years ahead of that curve of this is a guy who makes important films. But I just really want to start from the start with you and go, what was that film? What was that entry point to his work that you said, man, this is the kind of filmmaker that I want to be? This is someone I really admire.
Yeah, I mean, when I got exposed to him at first, I was probably 9 or 10 years old, and I was in a theater and I watched, I think it was Sophie's Choice at the time. I had caught up with All the President's Men because that came out in the mid-70s. I was way too young, but I did catch up with it during the 80s on VHS. And what I noticed more than anything about his films is they take a very documentary approach to things. And yes, I was always impressed by that. And I wanted to get into the film business and get into filmmaking because of Alan, more so than other filmmakers. There was something about Alan's work that just was so real to me. I got into fantasy. I got into Star Wars and all the other stuff, Indiana Jones, et cetera. But I always felt like it was a little removed from me because it was very, Hollywood. And it wasn't visceral. It wasn't like Alan's work where I was just brought into it and I felt like I was watching history unfold. Same with Parallax View. It's just like, did that really happen? Like, there was this element of Alan, like, almost you know, playing tricks with me. And the reason I got into filmmaking was because of Alan. And, you know, I went into features and narrative feature directing at first, but I realized that, you know, what I learned from Alan, what my attraction was documentary aspect of filmmaking. So I went into that and I kind of pursued about four or five documentaries and completed them, got distribution. And then I realized Alan's never had a documentary done. And I actually wanted to meet him eventually and thank him, but he died in 98. And I was kind of, you know, bereft about that. And I just felt like, what better way to thank this man than actually putting and piecing something together on him, because he was the one responsible for me, you know, having interest in filmmaking. Not that I can even get to his level. I don't think anyone really can, but he never wanted the spotlight, which was so interesting to me. So I don't know if doing this documentary actually betrayed what he actually wanted. But when I visited with his widow, Hannah, she had said, you know, he would probably really like your films, because she had seen some of the stuff I had done. And she's, you know, she was very much embracing the fact that I wanted to do this, because she is trying to protect and to elevate his legacy, and try to make sure that he stays in the conversation. Because I do think, as you just mentioned, things keep circling around to have him in the conversation again. And, you know, the more we, you know, evolve in our country here and around the world, you're seeing kind of some of this stuff unfold. I mean, the article today that just came out on the film, they were mentioning Parallax View in the same sentence as the Capitol riots. And it was like, wow, that's pretty remarkable timing. So it's like, yes. You know, I just feel like he's going to have a moment and continue to have a moment as things progress. And I was so lucky to be able to tell the story that I don't know why anyone else was avoiding it, or maybe just not, you know, wanting to approach it. But I felt like what a grand career, what a grand man. And, you know, he didn't disappoint. Everyone who spoke about him was so complimentary and, you know, fulfilled what I had always believed about his work.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because, you know, I was in the midst of doing All the President's Men as a minute by minute podcast on this show. And I thought I would really like to do it in parallel with what I think I can comfortably say I hope to be the last year of Donald Trump's presidency. And the unfathomable events of the year really continued to crystallize just how incredibly insightful and incredibly on point his work was, and how resonant it continues to be. So it doesn't surprise me in any fashion at all that you found that, that people are starting to compare, because the big thing is you can't mention the 70s really without mentioning Clute, Parallax View, and All the President's Men. You cannot mention it. You would be doing yourself a disservice by not talking about those films. So it's really funny that he, who's this really titanic force in the middle of that, is always been relegated to the sidelines. And it was such a joy, I must say, just your film, because, again, having been a person who spoke about him and his films for about 120 hours last year, I think it was so great. I was maybe I could have been the opposite of like the person who knew it all, but it was so refreshing as a fan of Bakula to hear these incredible artists like universally be like, oh yeah, he was like amazing. Like he was great. He made us all feel good. Like, everyone was just effusive. And it was like, yeah, it's really strange that, you know, just that choice of how, you know, how that kind of, you know, Easy Riders and Raging Bulls generation, there were some of the more self-mythological figures in that. And I don't think one of them is Martin Scorsese, even though he seems to be the guy that people brandish as the top one, but you know, the Coppolas and the De Palmas and things like that, there were cults of these men, the Lucases too, there were cults of these guys. And Bakula was a contemporary, but he just started out, you know, you're a New Yorker for life too. He started out as this, you know, erudite, sophisticated guy, you know, gets Harper Lee's rights to an incredible, you know, it's an incredible novel to adapt to begin with, because he's a sophisticated guy and he just loves making movies.
Yeah, I found that same aspect about his career, that, you know, he was this sophisticate and came from, and Tom Brokaw kind of echoed it, he came from like, you know, the establishment, he came from this intelligentsia, he was a Yale graduate, and he brought that aspect to his filmmaking in the beginning. He was a producer, and I think that served him well when he went on to direct, but he was a producer for the better part of a decade and a half. And finally, you know, when he hit his stride with that Paranoia trilogy, you're right. It's like, how do you not mention him in conversations about 70s and the great 70s films? You know, Soderbergh, I think, said it best in the film, where it's like, you know, there's that great moment when the Oscars are being handed out in 76 and they name all the films, Taxi Driver, All the President's Men, et cetera. And then Rocky gets it. And it kind of, like, to me, that signified what we were about to experience for the next, you know, several decades. And I think we're still in this. And it happened because of Jaws too, but I think Rocky and that seminal moment of them winning that Oscar that year, it's like, it was part of, you know, where American filmmaking was headed.
Yes.
And it was indicative of what happened in the 80s into the 90s and beyond. And we haven't really returned to the 70s film, that decade, and what was being offered then. And there's talk of it now. I mean, Scorsese just came out with this article, you know, saying about cinema and what we've lost. But there's a hypocritical nature to it, because he took Netflix and Apple money and he's, you know, coming down on the streamers, yet he's making streaming movies. So it's like, it's hard for me to, you know, take that too seriously. But I think Pakula, it would be interesting to know what he would have done now, because his life was cut short. But would he have, you know, gone into, you know, the streaming universe, and what would he have done? Would he have done a Marvel movie? You know, I asked that question to a few of the subjects, and they said he would have, but he would have done a villain, and he would have done some psychologically damaged villain who, you know, is in the corner and you don't think of.
They
him
wouldn't
much,
let but, they wouldn't let him near a Marvel movie, Matthew. Let's be real clear. They're never.
No, so, he could have done the Joker.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give him. I'll give him that. But. Look, it's definitely reaching for something that Alan would do, but he would have kept it grounded in a more psychological reality. Like, I don't think he would have played any kind of, he's not the kind of guy, you just get the sense, especially in my impressions of all of his films, is you just get the sense that he's able to, I don't know, he's such a director that is a fan of actors and how they internalize emotions and how that resonates in his films. Like, for example, The Pelican Brief is a movie, like, this year I've tried my darndest, and it's hard for me because anyone who knows listening, I very, very repetitive in my viewing habits, especially with films that really resonate with me, because I really want to get under the hood and get into the corners of why these things do it on a philosophical level, on a technical level. But I've watched Pelican Brief twice this year. And I continue to marvel at, it is such, could be such pulpy trash, but Alan brings something so incredible to it. Like, this really on point and a little bit scary, realistic view of the political and intelligence community entanglement. And then how the media has evolved to be a corporate arm and may or may not be able to sort of tell the stories that it wants to tell. Because throughout the whole discussion of All the President's Men, it was like, what are the films that actually get to show what journalism is now? And what's so funny is that, like, The Pelican Brief, which is sort of staring him in the face, is like, no, this is Pakula giving his updated commentary on what it is and what it has to be like and how these insiders are really going to start opening the doors to the next levels of conversations. And then you get the people, the torch carriers, like Michael Mann's The Insider, that comes a little bit later, which is, you know, presidents and networks, you know, the child of both of those movies. But yeah, I think you never want to think about it, because I just don't want to think about Alan Pakula making a Marvel movie. But I don't think that I think Alan would get kicked off of making a Marvel movie. Like, that's what would happen. He'd be like half make it, and they're like, no, we can't use Pakula. Let's hire someone else.
Well, he was very much in demand, and, you know, he always delivered. And I think a couple of people had commented that, you know, his specialty was the fact that he took these obscure stories, these things that wouldn't be mainstream, and, you know, they gave him carte blanche and he made them, you know, kind of mainstream and made them into these really great movies. I'm talking specifically about Clute, Parallax View, All the President's Men. But when you get on with Pelican Brief and with Presumed Innocent, I mean, those were huge novels. Those were, you know, things that he, you know, pretty much, you know, took a risk in trying to deliver what the novels delivered. And I think he succeeded on both fronts. But speaking of Pelican Brief, it was like, you know, Julia Roberts, the big thing there was when I interviewed her, she had said about how he, you know, she wanted to work with him so badly. She took 2 years off and was, you know, kind of unimpressed with Hollywood and where her career was headed. She came back into the fold with Pelican Brief and, you know, he took her in a totally different direction than what she was used to being regarded as. And, you know, he says in the film that, you know, she kind of turned into, went from being a girl to being a woman in that movie. And there's specific scenes that we point out in the documentary that, you know, reflect that. But, you know, Alan, he's such a, what's interesting that you mentioned about network, you know, my next thing I'm doing is on Paddy Chayefsky, and I kind of put him in the same category of, you know, screenwriter, director. Too bad they didn't work together, but it's like those two guys are so ahead of the curve about what's happening. And it's like even Chayefsky stuff is starting to come, you know, network and the parallels and the theories within that have kind of been around for the last 20 years. But I don't know, it's like those two guys, when they were at their zenith working in the 70s, it's like they had their finger on a pulse that was, you know, 50 years in the future. And I think we're starting to hear and feel the echo of it now. So that's why I'm concentrating now on Chayefsky. And it has, you know, an equally amazing cast coming together to talk about, you know, what Chayefsky was offering, which is in the same thing that Alan was, which is, you know, this highly intelligent filmmaking that I think it missed a lot of the audience at the time and continues to. It's like, you really, like, you can't watch Parallax View once and just not return to it and think about it and be like, wait, let me engage on that again. It's not a film like you just put on. You have to immerse yourself into it. And I don't think those films are streaming friendly. A lot of people, you know, they pause it, they come back the next day, whatever it is. But if you're in a theater and you're sitting and you've paid for it and you're really watching it, it brings you to another place. And, you know, what's interesting is when I interviewed Dustin Hoffman, he wasn't even aware of some of the things that Pakula was up to and all the President's Men. Like Redford had said that, you know, he was discussing with Gordon Willis that the newsroom was so bright because that's where the truth was being, you know, brought to life and brought out of the shadows, et cetera. And then when you went out in the street and into the homes where these people were, Bernstein and Woodward were trying to uncover what happened, it was all dark. It was all into the shadows. And it's like, you know, I brought that up to Dustin. He's like, I didn't even realize they were doing that. That was some, that's a revelation to me. Like, wow, I wish I'd have known that at the time. So it was like, you know, there's a lot of stuff there that went unsaid. And it's like only people who, you know, are kind of, I guess, sensitive, like Redford or Soderbergh or people like, you know, that I've discussed it with, they get it. And they are like, you know, those unsaid things are to me what I value Pakula with most, because he didn't go around saying, oh, well, this is what we did and this is why. He was never the one that wanted spotlight or was in the interview, you know, discussing it too much. It was always under the radar. And I questioned if he wanted to have his career highlighted like this, if he wanted me to delve into his personal life like I did. But I felt like, you know, you want to uncover a little about the man behind these things because they are profound and they are, you know, celebrated films. I mean, a lot of people don't even talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, the fact that he produced that. You know, he was the one who got
the fact that your documentary got to, he got the book, he got the rights, and that that he was introduced.
And he was in his 20s. He was a young producer. I mean, the guy was like a baby face producer
goes to meet one of the most infamous, famous authors in American literature and convinces her to take the book, meets her father, the character that the, you know, the ultimately the lead character is based upon. I mean, that is just unbelievable. Like, you know.
Yeah, and that's the first.
That's the beginning of his career. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really is amazing. And when you look at what Mulligan and Pakula produced in the 60s, I mean, that was serious work too. You know, a lot of those movies were not, you know, typical of what was being offered. So to me, he was against the grain the whole way. And it's like, what better subject to delve into? Unfortunately, he's not around, but there were enough interviews done with him, not necessarily on television, but more like archival interviews for, I think, the Directors Guild and other places, that I had a lot of material to work from, to have stuff in his own voice.
Yeah, there's really incredible parts of the doco that you get, you know, because even doing this show, All the President's Minutes, it was one of those things where I was looking for clips all the time, and you'd sometimes, they wouldn't be named right, or, you know, you couldn't, they weren't just as simple as typing in Alan Pakula or All the President's Men. And sometimes you come across them later. Someone go, I found this link and it was on, you know, in a thread, and you look at it and you're like, wow, this guy actually talking about his work on the film is so impressive. But we've talked about Steven Soderbergh a couple of times, and I look at, you know, we talked about Julia Roberts. I look at Julia Roberts and I look at Steven Soderbergh, and in particular, I look at Aaron Brockovich, and I'm just like, this is a marriage of a guy who is such a fan, a self-proclaimed fan, and an ongoing revisiting Pakula's work. Like, Aaron Brockovich doesn't exist without The Pelican Brief, and particularly doesn't exist without All the President's Men. Like, that movie is such a, it is cut from the same cloth in the most unbelievable way. I mean, he's Oscar nominated as a director for two films that year, Traffic and Aaron Brockovich. And it's just like an incredible feat to think that that's the guy. And he continues to have that, you know, that flow, that effortlessness in his career. And even as late as The Laundromat, you know, the Laundromat, mm-hmm. Soderbergh's recent one, it feels much in that same, you know, cut from that same cloth.
Absolutely. And he was a disciple of Alan's, and he, you know, was obviously really upset when he died, because I know he says, like, oh, I was getting to know Alan at the time. And they were having conversations about, you know, film, and he had just met Alan, you know, just prior to 98. So they were talking, and Alan had said to him, you know, if I was going to make a film, I would have made, he said that the film, the videotape film, I can't think
of it. Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape. He goes, that's a film I would have made. Like, Alan was saying to him, like, I think he sought Steven out because it was such a, probably a big reaction from Alan. He's like, that was a film I would have made. You know, and really effusive about it. And that's why I think it was such a sore, you know, thing that happened. And the way he died, you know, it's so crazy because, you know, I do know that when I got to know the people who knew Alan, people in his development office, people in his production company, they were saying he was so careful about what he ate. And, you know, he would always say, even back then, he was like, oh, this causes cancer, or this that and the other. And he was very, like, you know, he was paranoid, but he was paranoid in a very innocent way.
The guy who made Clute, The Parallax View, and All the President's Men was paranoid. It's a shock.
Well, my point is that he was paranoid.
No,
like,
I'm just
OCD
being cheeky
ways.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
You know what I mean, but, like, you know, an OCD way, not like he was a conspiracy theorist who was, like, out there and dressed wacky, but, you know, he was like this OCD guy who had, like, you know, who looked like he was straight out of a library at Yale. And, you know, he just, then he goes and down these roads, these rabbit holes of these movies. And you wonder, it's like, how deep does that go? Yes. And it's really, you know, he was so unassuming, because I went to his apartment, visited with the widow. And it's like, you know, this guy, there's no clue there that he was this person that would go down so deep, so layered in those films, because it looked like it could have been a lawyer or an accountant or a, you know, a professor's apartment. It wasn't something that was like, you know, there's these big shelf of books about, like, who killed JFK, all that stuff. You know, it was like very normal stuff. There's a lot of psychology books, I should say, around. And he was very much that kind of guy to immerse himself in conversation about psychological, you know, impact and trauma that people had experienced as kids. But, you know, I didn't get any clues just physically from his spaces that he was in, which I was hoping to, but I didn't see it.
It's also a massive surprise, I think, because, you know, when you talk about the 70s period, and now people are starting to discover those other things, you know, for example, Yellowstone, which is one of the biggest network shows in the world, but in America. You know, I caught Comes a Horseman as part of the project last year, and I'm like, hold on, wait, anyone who's watched Yellowstone Taylor Sheridan, if you're listening, anyone who's watched Yellowstone has seen Comes a Horseman with, you know, with Robards and James Caan and Jane Fonda. They've seen it. Like it's very much that sort of Titanic forces, external money, you know, the relationships of different family lines and ties. You know, he feels like he's adding a lot to that. Obviously Sophie's Choice with Meryl, which is, you know, seminal just on a performative level and like a hit, a cultural resonance in so much of his work. But like later on, it was much of a surprise. And now it's great that the, you know, the Pelican Briefs of the world, the Presumed Innocence of the world, the Devil's Owns of the world are starting to find their levels of appreciation too, because it feels like a lot of people, you know, when there's a glut of movies and things come by, you know, people can instantly dismiss things. But now that there's a fertile period, it feels like, in the post-90s or maybe post-1990 that is now being tapped in. These things that were made in the studio systems that weren't necessarily part of the new wave of the Tarantino era are starting to be revisited and going, actually, there's some really phenomenal stuff in here. And they may not have been all masterpieces, but when you know, look at them for their time and what they're trying to say, they're really doing some great stuff.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm curious what your thoughts are, because, you know, having an obsession with Heat, All the President's Men and Zodiac, et cetera, it's just like, you know, I'm a fan of those films too, but those films being made today are so few and far between. It just seems like, are we going to have another renaissance of the 70s? You know, are we going to have a renaissance of some of these films that, you know, just starred totally different and against the grain of Marvel and the big, I don't know. I feel like the pandemic, for some reason, maybe it was a refresher on Hollywood in a sense. Like there might be some sort of, because I don't think you're ever going to make a $200 million movie, a $200 million marketing budget on, you know, on top of that and get it back in the theaters like we used to. I could be wrong. Maybe there'll be a complete revolution and be like, we're going back to the theater in droves and it's going to be even bigger money that's coming in and they're going to continue this. Because you certainly can't do that with a Pakula film. If Pakula was alive today and they're like, let's put $30 million movie together and a, you know, a $10 million marketing budget, it wouldn't probably make its money back. And I don't know if that's because people aren't used to going to the theater anymore to see that kind of movie, or the crowd isn't there that wants to embrace that. I don't know. I mean, I just feel like times have changed enough where it's over in a sense.
I think it is and it isn't, because in Australia, there's a weird thing happening right now for like folks who are listening. As we're talking, it's 18th of February, not 17th of February in the United States. And in Australia, for the last like 2 or 3 weeks in a row, for the first time ever in our history, 3 Australian films are topping the box office. It's never happened before.
Interesting.
And look, they're not making huge amounts of money. Like they're not making your 20, 30 million Avengers Endgame in our local box office, which is, you know, equivalencies on population to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, et cetera, in the States, you know, when you ratchet up in population. However, the one of the big things is that people are craving these different local stories. Like the 3 stories, one of them's a family tale, like a sort of quirky family tale. I think they're all based on novels. One of them's an Eric Banner, you know, outback noir called The Dry. One's this sort of frontier revisionist tale set in post-World War I, you know, outback Australia called High Ground. This other one's called Penguin Bloom, stars Naomi Watts. So they've got some of our stars in them and things like that, but it's they're having a bit of a renaissance, and a bunch of people in our industry have been commentating and having some thoughts like, man, don't you wish now Australia made some goddamn movies while we could, because we could have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because people want to go to the movies, to especially adults. They want to go to the movies. They want to see films. And the event is there that like maybe your kids who are like glued to their Disney Plus subscriptions are going to see it. But like the event of a cinema is still there. And I think it's out there. I also just think that right now, the definition of like what is a streamer versus what is going to get out to a cinema is sort of happening. And I think I'm okay with the hypocrisy of Martin Scorsese criticizing the glut of like AI giving you recommendations versus curation, because people will pay Martin Scorsese to make movies. Because if Hollywood really cared, it'd be like, how do you lose Scorsese? How do you lose Alfonso Cuarón? You don't give them any money to make movies. And then you when you release it, you don't give it to a streamer so that more people can see it. You know, it just seems like it's a counterintuitive thing. You know, in my mind, I think that there's plenty of, I think there's plenty of opportunities for new kind of Pakula voices to come out, and it's going to be really interesting what happens. I'm personally interested on a local level in Australia, like going, okay, cool, more adult-ish focused Australian films might actually make the money because people want to go and see Australian-based stories at the cinema and getting in before the, you know, the US cinema comes back alive and then dominates again. I'm actually kind of interested.
Well, maybe it will. Maybe it will come from a foreign influence, because I really loved last year was that Korean film won every award,
and Parasite, you know, yeah,
it dominated, and it was like, wow, that also was I felt like a film Pakula would have made.
Oh yeah.
And it was like, you know, you have to follow the money, a great line from All the President's Men. It's like, if Hollywood sees that that's what's happening, they're going to go down that road, they're going to make more of those films. And it's like, you know, I just hope that moment wasn't lost by this washed out year and a half that we're experiencing of, you know, no films being really produced. But just
imagine, right, Matt, even, you know, now more intimately than anyone, All the President's Men, what kind of budget did I have? Under 10 million at the time. So if we ratchet it up, even like for crazy inflation, let's just say it was like $40-50 million. It does have the biggest movie star in the world, and it's going to open on a bunch of screens. It absolutely made its budget back. And I just think that also that, you know, this marketing, like here, add 20 million here, do those sorts of things. You know, even the streamers themselves are frustrating because they release these movies and then they don't spruik them. You know, I think that some of the smaller streaming services actually are doing themselves a good service, because like when they've got a new big release, it's on the front page of their streaming service. Whereas like sometimes with Netflix, you hear about a movie coming out and it's just not even in the front. It's not being curated. You're like, where is it? Where's this new movie? Hold on. Where's that? Where did that go? So yeah, I think there's definitely room. You know, I think there's definitely room. And I think you only have to look at just how influential his work has been. And it's just like, people are looking at IP all the time. You know, I feel like when you look at Alan's work, it's like, there'll be a television adaption. There might be a remake. There might be something, maybe not of the Holy Trinity in the middle of his career, or the President's Man, Parallax, and Clute, but you certainly see that. Or actually maybe Clute, you know, getting readapting and trying to do a little bit more Clute tales, but not necessarily about Fonda's character. But yeah, I feel like it's pretty ripe. It's pretty ripe for stuff. Like, he had an instinct for these kind of emotionally complex things that people could really engage with.
No, I agree. And I'm hoping that this documentary resonates enough with the people, because there's so many disciples of Pakula's in Hollywood, you know, that got into the business the same way I did, and you know, were raised on these films. And I do hope that this film resonates with some of them to, you know, kind of bring about some of these films again. Because, you know, I certainly bemoan the fact that they're not made as much. But you know, it's funny because the films that you highlight, All the President's Men and Heat, those things kind of got, what was Heat's box office? It wasn't huge. I know that got its audience afterward,
about 60 million in the States. I don't know what that, like it kind of made its budget back, but it was an altogether largely abandoned movie. When, like, you know, when you look at it later and you're like, it didn't get any love from the Academy.
No.
It's got two of the greatest, you know, cinematic men of all time in it. It's got Michael Mann and directing.
Did you ever talk to Van Zandt?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't get to talk to Van Zandt.
I know William Fichtner pretty well. I've met with him a few
times. Matt, this is what I'm going to tell you. On this show, we still continue to put out the odd One Heat Minute. We were lucky enough to have Michael Mann, but as early as a month ago, we put out a special bonus episode because I was able to talk to Tom Sizemore.
I saw a clip of that. Yeah.
You know, I would just say to you, you know, if you know Van Zandt, we can hook it up afterwards. I'd love to talk to Mr. Fichtner. But it's funny that it's kind of abandoned. And look, strangely enough, All the President's Men was one of the most lauded films that so far on our sort of ongoing series of these deep dive examinations has actually received critical acclaim at the time that it actually deserved it. And it's only crystallized because of how unbelievable 1976 was as a filmmaking year, that you kind of start to freak out a bit about, like, oh my God, like the same year as Network, the same year as Taxi Driver, like what is going on? You know, because of all these, this confluence of huge films and how important and impactful they are. But yeah, like even Zodiac, you know, made in 2007, it kind of was drowned by the There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, Michael Clayton's of the world, and kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. And then because of, you know, Fincher being a kind of carrying the torch of almost Kubrick, if you like, has sort of now grown into a sort of cult reputation of its own.
No, absolutely. I remember when that came out and I was like riveted, and I was hoping that it was going to get more. And you're right, it did get a little bit drowned that year, now thinking about those two films you mentioned. But I liked Michael Clayton as well. I thought that was a good movie.
That's a movie that Alan would make. That's a movie that
A movie Alan would make. And actually, Clooney, I interviewed Clooney for a different film, but I wanted to get him for this as well, because I know Steven had said he and George, when they were partnered up, they were definitely talking about Pakula films, and that's the kind of things they wanted to do. And you know, I do think that Clooney kind of is, the recent one he did on the, you know, the space, the one that he did on Netflix.
The Midnight Sky, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like that was definitely Pakula-esque, and it's like he's an interesting guy. I mean, he definitely is carrying a torch there as well, because I think he was definitely impacted in those years when he...
Good night and good luck. You know, there's a whole... You know, if the great text of like journalism movie is, in my mind, All the President's Men, I think everything else is secondary, and I'm extremely biased in saying that, and I'm sure you probably are too. But like, you know, it's like President's Men and Network are very close to one another, and then you've got the next high crop of quality films are like The Insider and Good Night and Good Luck, and even Frost Nixon, yep, to a certain extent, Broadcast News, The Paper. You know, there are good journalism movies all over the place. But yeah, like I think, you know, he's definitely operating in that same area. That's for sure.
Yeah. And as I said, I wanted to talk to him about Pakula, and it's like, you know, there are these things, you know, he's a big Chayefsky, I think, fan as well. So it's like, eventually I'll circle back around to him, but it's just, you know, I could have talked to so many more people. A lot of them have passed away. You know, that new Pakula, it would have been a smorgasbord of people, but you know, you can keep going and going. I think I interviewed close to 100 people total. And it's, you know, it's sad because it's like, what could have been? He died when he was 70, but, you know, his parents lived well under their 90s. So he had at least a couple of decades, I think, of quality films to go. So it's like the fact that he was cut short, it's unfortunate, because what could have been, what would have been in his mind to do. He had a lot of plans, and the last film he was working on when he died was one on FDR, because FDR was when he was growing up, you know, back in the 30s. And I'm sure that would have been, you know, a really interesting take on FDR and his life. So,
and Eleanor, Jane Alexander for Eleanor.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
She told us
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
What a sliding doors moment for Jane, who's mm-hmm. been basically essaying that character in a variety of forms for decades, and coming back with Alan after, you know, what I think is probably one of the scenes of the 70s in the strongest decade of American cinema ever, maybe one of the greatest scenes that's ever been committed to film, you know, and he probably one of his proudest scenes as well, and just how effortlessly they constructed that, and getting them together in a full film would have been pretty damn special. What is your favorite?
It would have been.
What's your favorite Pakula film, Matt? Are you allowed to say?
My favorite? I don't know. I feel like Presumed Innocent was one of the highlights for me because of what he did with Harrison.
Yes.
And I asked Harrison about it. I said, you know, the fact that you're Indiana Jones, now you're in this movie, like you're kind of like going against who you are. And he got annoyed with me because he's like, what do you mean I'm an actor? I do. I'm like, yeah, but you were known for this and now you're doing this. So he went off about the haircut he was given, etc. But I just felt like that film really pulled you through successfully. If you didn't know the book, if you didn't know the wife, was the one, not to spoil it, but I did. But it's amazing that, you know, you get pulled all the way to the end without really knowing. And that's hard to do. A lot of people predict. But to me, it's like, you know, he took you on a ride with that film. Although that's an 80s thing. And that, like, that was part of Sophie's Choice, Presumed Innocent, Pelican, etc. But, you know, I guess.
I mean, he has a couple of. Harrison Ford in that period feels like he leapt away from what he was known for. From like 85, he does Witness, which is still one of my favorite films of all time. Mosquito Coast.
And an Australian with Peter Weir, right? Mosquito Coast.
The great Peter Weir. Yeah, so he goes Witness, Mosquito Coast. He's got Frantic and Working Girl in there. And then he has the next Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, which is 89. And then he rolls straight from that into Presumed Innocent. And so it's just, I tend to agree. It's this whole... It's a fun, like a little challenge in his career, of like fighting against that typecasting. But I think he's done a pretty damn good job. I mean, when you Rick Deckard, who's on a picture behind me as we're talking that the people listening won't be able to see, but like when you Rick Deckard and Han Solo and Indiana Jones, it's to do anything else and to do it really well and to be able to immerse yourself into the role. Like, and even later, like Dr. Richard Kimball and Jack Ryan, like it's just like his career is just like insane for these iconic characters that he's able to embody. And, but yeah, like I think Presumed Innocent is having a new life too, because people are going back and going, man, this is just like so many great actors and all of the coolest movies. You just get all these great actors and everyone's doing great work. And you're just like, wow, how did this happen? When did they stop making movies that have all great actors? Like, that's the thing that stumps me every time with something like The Pelican Brief. It's like, look at how many great actors are in this movie. Like, just pound for pound, every role, just completely unbelievable. And you're just, yeah, that's a, it's incredibly special thing that he was able to do.
No, I agree. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't say, oh, Presumed Innocent, but I'll put it up there only because of what I had said about Harrison. I feel like that was, there's an interesting take on him in that, which I appreciate.
Matt, look, it's been a real treat talking to you. And it's actually a huge treat to finally have seen the film. For anyone who's in Australia, just the best thing that you guys can do is jump onto JIFF, Jewish International Film Festival. So jiff.com.au, go search for Alan Pakula Going for the Truth. It is actually coming this weekend. So you can book tickets literally as you're listening now. If you're listening to it as this episode drops, this bonus episode, just have a listen. That would be amazing. But look, Matt, I was absolutely target audience. And I think anyone who listened to the duration of this show is absolutely target audience too. So I can pretty safely say that everyone will enjoy it. It's so amazing that you're able to document, you know, and bring light to this guy, even though he maybe wouldn't have wanted it. But I tell you what, all of his fans want him in the spotlight because he's made some incredible films that are deeply resonant. And enduring. So look, just thank you so much for having a chat with me, and best of luck with the film. I can't wait to consume it again when it comes in its full release.
Thank you again. Yeah, thank you for having me, and please check out the film. It needs all the support we can get, and it'll have wider distribution eventually. It's just it's starting to bubble up in Hollywood at the moment.
Well, reach out anytime, and next time we talk to William Fichtner's Van Zandt after the next call, we'll make sure we spruik Alan Pakula Going for the Truth. Thanks, Matt. Have all the best.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.